we study and we try to understand if by including women in a militarized society or into a militarized situation like the military, does that feminize the army or does it masculinize the women?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Long to spend time with my sisters.
Welcome to Women on the Line, Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs Program, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. I'm Rachel O'Connell. On today's program, we're talking about Israelis challenging militarism.
Our position is a protest against the occupation, and these checkpoints are one of the side effects of occupation. They exist, so there was a need for them to be monitored and observed.
That was Judy Orstov, member of Maxom Watch, whose members monitor and report on Israeli checkpoint activity. Also on the show is Ruth Hiller, the co-founder of New Profile, an Israeli movement which campaigns for the demilitarization of Israeli society. The system of checkpoints operated by the Israeli authorities and used by Palestinians is seen by some as an overt display of Israel's control over Palestinians. Israel, however, maintains that checkpoints are essential for reasons of security. Israeli-based human rights organization Maxom Watch was established in 2001 in response to media reports in Israel about the behavior of Israeli soldiers at some checkpoints. Judy Orstov is an Australian who has lived in Israel for 34 years and is a member of Maxom Watch. So Judy, for people who might not be aware, what is the checkpoint system and why did it evolve?
There are two different kinds of checkpoints. There are checkpoints that are between the territories and Israel itself, and there are checkpoints around Jerusalem, and there are checkpoints within the occupied territories. Before the First and Second Intifada, there were very few checkpoints. There were checkpoints as borders, and they've just become more and more. As the situation became more and more serious, as more and more suicide bombers or more and more terrorist activities going on, the checkpoints were a reaction to that.
How many checkpoints are we talking about here?
Look, there are about 500 or 600, which is an enormous amount. There are large checkpoints that are, I suppose, really security checkpoints, and there are these other checkpoints that are in the Palestinian territories and in the occupied territories that check the Palestinians as they go from village to village or within that area, which are, as far as I can see, not so much security-based, but rather a way of checking on their movements, imposing authority, aggravating all those terrible things.
So your involvement is from a human rights perspective?
Yes, absolutely, from a human rights point of view. I mean, our position is a protest against the occupation, and these checkpoints are one of the side effects of occupation. They exist, so there was a need for them to be monitored and observed.
So what exactly are the purposes of Maxom Watch? What is it? What are its aims?
Number one, it's a protest. It's a protest against the occupation. Our standing there at the checkpoint is also a political protest against the occupation. The second thing would be to observe and record what was going on there so that every time a shift goes out with two or three women, they come back and they write a report of what went on, especially the problematic situation. So there's a report, there are ongoing reports all the time of what is going on at the checkpoints so that no one can say that we didn't know what was going on. And the third thing that we want to do, if we can, is to, in extreme cases or in unusual cases, to facilitate or to help in some way, if we can, by making phone calls, by communicating with the soldiers, by making special requests for either sick people or people who've been held for too long. There are all sorts of situations where we can intervene, at least attempt to intervene, and ease the situation.
I understand that all the checkpoints can be very different, but using your checkpoint, the one that you monitor, as an example, can you describe the process of going through a checkpoint?
I've been to a few. At the moment, I go to one, it's Calandia, which is a very, probably the largest, or one of the largest checkpoints near Jerusalem, and it's the one that you go through in order to go north to Ramallah. And it's a really big terminal, and it's become completely mechanized, so that there's very little direct contact between soldiers and Palestinians, because everything's sort of automatic. It's like going through the checking at an airport, so they have to wait in queues, and then they go through these, what we call carousels, these revolving gates, and then they come to the place where they have to put their bags, and they have to take off their belts, and they have to show their identity cards, and they have to show their permits, etc., etc., and then they go through that, and then they go through several other of these revolving doors or within the terminal, and then they go out. But I mean, the actual checking may not take all that long. It's just that if there are lots of people, the time spent there can be a long time.
Would they go through a lot of these checkpoints every day?
Well, it depends on where they live. If they live where they have to go to, some would have to go through several checkpoints, yes. I once helped a woman drove her to a hospital from Calandia, which is just outside Jerusalem, to a hospital in Jerusalem, and she came from Nablus in the north, and she had to go through several checkpoints and take taxis in them in between, and then walk, and then before she got to Calandia, where I was, and then I took her to the hospital because there was not an appropriate treatment for her near where she lived. So yes, she would have had to have spent several hours going through several checkpoints in order to get to Jerusalem.
I'm interested in the reaction you receive from people you encounter. Firstly, the Palestinian people themselves, how do they respond to your presence at checkpoints?
Well, on the whole, very, very positively. They're really, often they come and thank us and say, you know, it's so important that we're there. And sometimes we've specifically helped people, so they remember us. But on the whole, very, very positive. The soldiers are more ambivalent because the soldiers feel that we're coming to check on them and to criticise them, which is not really the point. The point is just to see that human rights are being maintained and that at these checkpoints are as humane as possible under the circumstances.
So simply having a Maxon watch presence there actually has a positive effect on the checkpoints?
Often. Look, nothing of what I say is always. It's often and it's sometimes. The fact that there are civilian eyes makes a difference. The fact that the soldiers and everyone there know that there are people there observing and reporting has a lot of influence. And of course, we have contact with the newspapers and with people in the army, and if we see that something really is not justified or humiliating, there are people in the army that we can actually talk to. Over the years, it's certainly brought the checkpoint to the public eye because there have been an enormous number of articles about it in the newspapers. But on the whole, the Palestinians, yes, are very aware of our presence, very aware of what we're doing, and are very appreciative, and it's very important for them to see that there are also Israelis like this.
And what about the wider community? Do you have a lot of support within the wider community for the work that you're doing?
You know, we've been often, there are people within Israelis, who don't understand why on earth we're doing. You know, why don't we worry more about the people in Sderot who are being bombed or where the rockets are being fired, and why don't we help the poor in Israel or whatever it is? Well, yes, one should also help those people. But I'm Israeli, or I'm now Israeli, and I live in Israel. This is my country, and I care about it, and I think terrible things are happening here. And it's important for me, because I'm Israeli, to be there, because I care about what my country is doing. Some Israeli will say, oh, you know, you just care about the Palestinians, you know, why don't... But it's not that I just care about the Palestinians. I do care about the Palestinians, but I care about what is being done in my name. I mean, I'm terribly critical of Israeli policies, and I feel I have a right to be critical because I live here, and I have a slight problem with this blanket criticism of Israel from outside, because I think most people don't understand the complexities of this situation, and the Palestinians are not always right. That doesn't mean that I agree with what we're doing, but it does mean that I think that the Palestinians are also responsible.
I think it's interesting to hear your perspective, because there isn't really much coverage of the fact that there are Israelis who don't agree with the policies of their authorities.
Well, there are enormous number of Israelis who don't agree. Enormous number of Israelis. A lot of people in Israel also don't understand that I'm doing it because I'm so concerned about what kind of country this is becoming. And I don't believe that if there's immoral conduct on one side of the line, like the green line, that's the line that separates Israel and the territories, I can't see how, if we're doing immoral things on that side of the line, we can have a healthy society on this side of the line. So, and I think it's all connected.
On Women on the Line, Judy Orstov from Israeli human rights group Maxon Watch is speaking about her work monitoring checkpoints. Highlighting the restricted freedom of the Palestinians is a major concern of Maxon Watch from a human rights perspective. And the permit system for Palestinians, you mentioned it, it's complicated and time-consuming. Maxon Watch has recently started focusing on the issue of security blacklisting of Palestinians. Mm. Can you explain what that's all about?
There are a lot of Palestinians on this blacklist, and some of them justifiably, but a lot of them are there, and they don't quite know why they've been there, why they've been put there, and they don't have any way of finding out why they're there. And it could be that some relative once threw a stone, or someone had once, you know, not even directly concerned with them, but because they were connected to someone who did do something, they've been blacklisted. Now, there is someone, there are a few women in, not I'm not involved in that, but a few women in the Maxon Watch dealing with this problem and working with these people who don't know why they're on the blacklist and don't have any access to knowledge and have not been told.
So is it quite hard for them independently to get their name off a blacklist?
Yes, because they don't know how to go about it. And when they simply ask, for example, at some office where they're trying to get a permit, they're just told that they're blacklisted and they're not ever told why. So then this, some of the women in Maxon Watch have been able to get access to information or to people that will give information and have been able to actually remove some of the people from the blacklist. And that's really excellent work, I mean, because it's very focused. Because if they're on the blacklist, then they can't do anything. They can't get permits to work. They can't do anything. And they can't get what they call a magnetic card, which is the first thing that you get. And then with that magnetic card, they can get their permit.
If you're blacklisted, you can't go to work, you can't carry out your normal life.
You can't do anything.
What are your hopes for the future for Maxon Watch, and where do you see it all going?
Oh, I mean, that's a question I can't answer.
Hmm.
I mean, Maxon Watch will exist as long as there are these checkpoints. I mean, the dream is that there'll be negotiations and that there'll be a Palestinian state and there'll be a border and there'll be checking at the border from one country to the other, and that the other checkpoints, the internal checkpoints in the territories will not exist. I mean, but that it seems such a dream because it doesn't seem to be getting any closer to that.
That was Judy Orstov. On community radio around Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line. Go to womenontheline.org.au to download this week's program. All the things I long for, I yearn for. Stories to listen to. And she's got a story too. To make you happy. Israel is one of the most militarized countries in the world. Young Israelis undertake compulsory military service, and vast military resources are employed on a daily basis in the name of security. So what impact does such militarization have on civil society? Ruth Hiller is an Israeli peace activist who co-founded New Profile, the movement for the civilization of Israeli society. What's the traditional attitude to military service within Israeli society? How is it viewed?
It is considered your national duty. It's part of a whole indoctrination process, this is our contention, that teaches us that there is no other choice and that we're always under the threat of enemies and that we're always going to have to be at war.
So in a way, military service is seen as a way of demonstrating loyalty to the state.
Yes, absolutely. And following the elections and the campaigns that were going on where there was calls to loyalty, if you're not loyal to your country, if you don't abide by all the rules and regulations, then you're not considered faithful or you're not considered a true citizen of Israel. Israel has mandatory conscription for its Jewish citizens, and it's a little bit complicated because it's not just Jewish citizens, it's a small minority also of Arab citizens of Israel. It's a common belief that The only people who live in Israel are Jewish, but in actual fact, 20% of the population is not Jewish. The conscription process doesn't just start when children are 18 years old. It's an ongoing life process from the time that they're born. And as parents, we're taught that there's no other choice. Our children are born into a situation when they're 18, they're going to go into the military. And there's a process, you know. A child is born, goes to nursery school, goes to elementary school, on to high school, and into the military. And it's accepted. And the thing is here, we want people to question. We don't say to them, don't go, do go. What we're saying is, if you do choose to go, and we believe it's a choice, if you feel that this is what you are supposed to be doing, then question it. Question where they're going to send you. Question what you're going to be doing. Question how much of your life is going to be involved in this. When we talk about a militarized society, we're not just talking about military. We're talking about a civil society that is controlled by a military mindset. If we look at who are our politicians, if we look at who are our CEOs in our major industry, if we look and see who are the people of influence, there's a good chance that the person you're looking at has a very, very rich military record. How many of our teachers or our principals are ex-military people, people who have retired from the military as a career officer and have changed their occupation? So those are the kind of things that we want people to be aware of.
You're one of the founders of New Profile. It's been operating since 1998. What are the key principles of New Profile?
The key principles are to work towards demilitarizing Israeli society and to create an egalitarian state within all its people are equal and to end the occupation in the long run.
Can you tell us a bit about how and why the organization started?
In 1995, my oldest son told me that he refused to serve in the military on the grounds that he realized that he was a pacifist. He was 15 years old, and he came up to me and he says, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I cannot serve in the military on the grounds of my belief in pacifism. And that sort of jolted me because I'd always been like a back burner activist. And so it made me realize that I had to become more involved. I decided to be with him and support him. And if I did that, then I would have to change my lifestyle as well. I would have to accept the fact that there would be a certain amount of ostracization. I had to protect him in any way I could. We knew that we had to find a legal path that we could help him get out of the military. And we didn't have any information about what we wanted to do. At the same time, Israel was involved in Lebanon. And we were all going out intersections, major intersections, every day for an hour a day and demonstrating against the war in Lebanon. And you'd go down Israel's major highways, and you would see 44 different intersections populated by these women dressed in white saying, withdraw from Lebanon. Mm. And at one of these demonstrations that I went to, and I was going to them daily, I met another woman who spoke at the end of the demonstration. So I went home, and I called her up, and I said, you know, I really like what you said, and I want to learn more. She says, well, you know, we just opened a study group, and that study group was together for a year and a half, before a small group of us decided to regroup into a new project and talk about the right to conscience. We knew that there was a lot of people that were going into the military or not going into the military, people who were going into the military and leaving it. And we wanted to know, let's question conscience. Who goes? Who doesn't go? Who has the right to conscience? Do only religious people have a right to conscience? All those kind of questions. So we held what we call a study day. And we opened it up to the public, and 150 people showed up for that study day. And we understood that there was a dialogue, that people wanted to talk.
What kind of membership base do you have? Is it? It's a feminist organization, but is it just women?
It's a very interesting question, because our membership, and aside from the original women who got together to start the organization, we're multi-age. It's men and women and youth between the ages of 16 and 80. We work on feminine principle, but we don't have our own office. We work out of our home. We don't have a board. We'll have people working in teams. So we have, at any given moment, something like 32 different projects ongoing all year round. And we're called New Profile for two reasons. The Israeli word for the Hebrew or the Israeli word for military classification is profile. So we wanted people who were refusing to serve in the military to be awarded a different military profile, not just a medical deferment, but a profile that would recognize a right of conscience or a right of choice. The second reason that we called ourselves New Profile is because we really do want to change the civilian profile of Israel from to a civil society as opposed to a militaristic or a society that's based on militaristic principles.
New profile strongly supports the notion of freedom of conscience. How hard is it for young people to be anti-war in such a pro-war climate?
Well, I think they face tremendous odds. One of the things that happened when my son was objecting is that we realized that there wasn't enough information available, accessible to the public. The body that is supposed to provide information about conscious objection is, oddly enough, it's the military. And the military does not provide the information freely. So one of the few things, the first things that we did when we became an organization was cultivate information. Every time somebody turned to us for assistance, we would gather that information together in order to create a database for ourselves. Now, the thing is, we don't go and ask people, do you want to serve or don't you want to serve? Our interest is that if people want the information, they should be able to get it. Today, you can get into our website, and there's an access form there. We have a group of people who are what we call part of our counseling network, people who are experienced in the, understand the matters. You know, they answer all the questions that they came up. When they do decide not to go into the military, and we know that it's going to be a legal struggle, we are willing to consider supplying them with legal aid.
You're listening to Ruth Hiller, co-founder of New Profile, speaking about the effect of militarization on Israeli society.
Well, you live in a constant state of fear. I think that would be the first thing that I would say people who come to Israel will notice. As citizen of Israel, I walk down I don't see all the military weapons around me. I don't see the submachine guns, and I don't see the pistols, and I don't hear the sonic booms of the planes flying over. And I don't see those things, but when a tourist comes to Israel, it's shocking because they are everywhere. There are guns everywhere. So just as if we were to consider taking that element out of the street, and you wouldn't have soldiers going off base with military weapons, or you wouldn't have security guards leaving their posts at the bank and not checking in their weapon at their company office. So we become so used to it on the name of security, because that's the only way that we could be saved, just in case something happens. There's all these guns go around all the time, and it's considered normal. It's considered something very, very acceptable, and nobody questions it. So if we take just that issue, for example, and we start raising the question about presence of military weapons in public domain, there would be a very, very difficult discussion within Israel. You wouldn't expect seeing that amount of weapons on the beach, in the trains, in a shopping mall, all the time.
So do you think that strong military presence actually serves to create greater insecurity?
An ambience of fear, ongoing. If somebody's going to do something to us, if somebody's going to hurt us, instead of saying, if I'm so fearful, what do I do to make it better? How do I make myself secure so that I won't feel that I might be attacked by this person? You know, I'm a mother, and it's the basic, you know, thing to, you don't let your children hit one another. You teach them to talk. This is the same thing. You don't let people kill one another. You want them to find a different kind of solution that is not so painful. And you know, Israel is over 60 years old. You would think that after 61 years, this is a country that just doesn't get it. Violence does not work.
Israeli authorities seem to view a militarized society as the only option for its security and ultimate survival. Do you think that Israel is capable of peace politics or of finding another way?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely think that. I think Israelis have to learn to be accountable for their actions as well. It's not a one-sided deal here. And it's not just about pointing the finger at somebody and saying, because of them, that's why we are today. I recognize shadows of fascism coming over this country after the last election and the increase of power for certain political parties, the very, very extreme right. And, you know, I wasn't born in Europe, but I've spoken to people who were born in Europe in the 20s, and it scares them because it feels just like what it felt before Hitler came into power.
You were saying about Israeli society is sort of structured around the military. If an Israeli soldier is kind of a hero of society, male soldiers are presumably at the top of the hierarchy of society. So where do women fit in, both in the army and in normal society?
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's something that we discuss a lot in New Profile, the role of women in enabling a militarized society to continue. And women traditionally are the cheerleaders, people who take on the service roles. And even so in the military, although you see more and more women going into combat units, traditionally their role is a service provider, as a secretary, as a clerk, somebody who's in the back lines supporting a unit. We study and we try to understand if by including women in a militarized society or into a militarized situation like the military, does that feminize the army or does it masculinize the women? From our experience and what we've learned from people who have researched it, that women in militarized roles in their small community, whether it's military or it's a security guard unit, they tend to become more masculinized than feminized. They do not feminize the people around them. They adopt aggressive behavior.
And so presumably you think that's detrimental for society as a whole then?
It doesn't create equality. I think the only way that you can really have equality is if conscription is a choice, and then people choose where they want to go according to their capability. Our take is not to have a military. That's not what we're saying, don't have an army.
I was interested actually to know whether you see a place for military at all in society.
We don't even discuss should there be a military or should there not be a military. We know there should be something different. We know that conscription should be abolished.
How would you envisage a demilitarized Israel to look? What were your hopes for it?
Well, what I would like to see is really an army of choice, meaning if we would say get rid of conscription. And then we would not make key positions within the society available to people who are, for the most part, ex-military people. I would like to see a country that really does work towards the equality of all its citizens, and not just because you're Jewish or you're not Jewish, and to take into consideration that there was a history to this country before it was established, and there's still people who are living here who were here before Israel became a state, and they have to be considered as equal citizens in all respects.
Well, it's a new and a stories listen to.
That was Ruth Hiller, co-founder of New Profile. And that's all for the program today. Women on the Line is Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program. It is produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. We greatly appreciate the financial support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you'd like to contact the producers of Women on the Line, you can phone 3CR on 03 9419 8377 or email us at womenontheline@hotmail.com. Women on the Line programs can be downloaded from our website, womenontheline.org.au. The theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Ann Cox's She's Got a Story Too. I'm Rachel O'Connell. I hope you can tune in again next time.
Wings thanks Women on the Line for sharing this program. Wings and Women on the Line have exchanged our work since 1986. Thanks also to your local radio station, to Suzette Cullen, and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. For more about Wings, check our website, www.wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.